Our speaker this morning is Reverend Carl Lipsey, a man who wears many hats and a man who does large in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod when everyone talks about issues in human relations. As you all know, he is on the theological faculty of Appalachian University. But it's particularly in his capacity as Executive Secretary of the Lutheran Human Relations Association that he's here to speak to us this morning. His name is familiar to many of us, the Elder Vanguard and Airbus, if nothing else. And it's really to our gain that this morning he is here with us to present his person to us on this day of theological reception. He has chosen as his theme the responsibility of the clergy in a reconciling church, and I think it's appropriate to note in introducing him that while it's not the case with every theological word, the word reconcile or reconciliation seems to be one of those words that functions both within theological context and non-theological context. And on this day of theological reception on issues in human relations, it's greatly to our advantage and marvelously appropriate that we have Reverend Carl Lipsey here to speak to us on this theme. Reverend Lipsey?
Let's call it a keynote, and let's not call it a guest. You have ample good teachers and examples of good teaching, so don't be critical at all that stuff. I did come with a pretty well-prepared idea of things I wanted to talk. But in a sense, this isn't a keynote either, because there's a lot of stuff been going already, and if I start some kind of a note, it must be either off the key that has already been established or one that really isn't wanted. I've tried to, including what I've pulled together here, some of the things that I've already observed last night and this morning. So if we seem to have less coherence than a well-organized outline, please forgive that. One more thing, the temptation of discussing something like this in a theological setting is to get into the area of jargon and abstraction and really to forget about people. And I hope very much we'll be able to concentrate on this, that whatever we're talking about is finally going to center in terms of reality and life and death. Because a few years ago, in a special meeting that was called by President Duncan to discuss the implications of the 1954 Supreme Court decision on desegregating schools, we had a group of men were gathered around to see really what this meant, what kind of imperatives were presented to the Christians, what kind of opportunities were there. I remember this aged gentleman who really was a little out of touch with the reality of this, saying to me personally, on that occasion, I love the Negro. Does that mean I must fraternize with him? Forgive me if I don't do a very good job of pronouncing it just as he did. But my response was something like this: man, that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
Dear brother, remembering who our Father is, and all the while remembering who our brother Jesus Christ is, what he did and what he still does. And then I take on Martin Luther this point altogether. But I do think that a lot of people have twisted and abused his little term about urging people to be little Christ. I'd like to stay a little bit closer to the scriptural concept of all of the little people growing up together to be the first stature and expectation that God has built in to his plan, where we combine to be a great big Jesus Christ in the world, and don't minimize our need for serving the very corporate world. We'll talk about that later. Getting back to our brother Jesus, who invited us to call his Father our Father, he told of a brother who had been out of the family, away from home. And the doors of that home and of that father's heart were always open to the son. And when this one runaway son came home, before his membership in the family was celebrated, the father wanted him to have a shirt on his back and a very fine coat, and not a mere bowl of soup and coffee, but soap from a fatted calf and a decent room. And at least one brother resented it very much. This in the context of the present racial situation in America, we were dealing with black brothers by creation, brothers whom our Lord intends to have membership in the family by virtue of his redemptive work, brothers who have not really run away in the sense that they've gone and wasted something they knew, but brothers who have really not been welcomed wholeheartedly into the family by other brothers, and for the most part have not been allowed at the father's table with the rest of the brothers. Think about it. And think about the grave concern of the church through the years. I'm talking now about our own particular communion, the conception of the image. I'm going to ask you to think about a concept that Sam House of the Commons in Chicago, an organization that works with voluntary agencies, especially in the field of human relations, has to say. He observes that there is nothing really that makes the power structures on national and local levels quite as happy as that American institution called the voluntary agency, especially if these voluntary agencies were busy themselves with service projects. For that reason, our recent president allowed his ladybird to be busy organizing garden clubs all over the United States, so that they would be picking up pink cones, finding flowers on the boulevard. And that's great. You got busy people doing something that probably the government should have been doing anyway. But you see, in different levels, the Kiwanis Club, the Lions Club, Chambers of Commerce, Union Chambers of Commerce, encouraging the kind of thing like bringing in all the kids' bicycles and putting reflective tape on them so the little kids don't get jostled out in the highways. Gathering spectacle rooms for sending over to Hungary for people who lost their glasses in the revolution. Busy services, and not bad in themselves. But as long as they are doing these things, the structure can continue as always, unchallenged and unchanged. Steinhardt said, what a wonderful thing it is when voluntary agencies really get themselves together on a voluntary basis to challenge the structure. As was the case when a group of people went down to Springfield in Illinois to challenge the lawmakers who were going to cancel out in a great budget-saving effort, help to welfare people. They would have preferred for these people to be busy making layups, you know, little combinations of diapers and blankets and safety things to give to expectant welfare mothers. Go ahead, do that. Just don't mess with us as we are trying to administer a whole lot of things. Don't change the system, the structure. And in the process now, whenever the structure gets changed, there's too much change that occurs that threatens some bigger things that we have for our vested interests. Somehow suggests that the church is a voluntary agency, which is given sanction, legal, for doing service projects, which basically now, touch this, provide for social mobility within the structure without changing the structure. Possibly finding a peer, clearly cleared family and giving them clothes, possibly finding a man who doesn't have a very good job and giving him another, but not really changing the structure. Now, churches have a way of operating the same way and developing their structures in such a way that they will tolerate service organizations, voluntary organizations that do service projects in their midst. You know, if the ladies' aid, for example, were so great for the education room, and if the men will mow the lawn, and just so long as whatever the church is trying to do in its accustomed way, as it pursues its goals of building bigger and better buildings, of enlarging the Sunday school, of getting the budget fattened up, or whatever, just so long as some of the concerns in there aren't molested, we can tolerate it. Well, it seems to me that the hope of the church and the hope for government or any system or structure is that the voluntary agencies get beefed up and that they really won't settle for service projects, but they're going to do something. Service project is Christmas baskets for the poor. Structure change is to get the big aircraft company in town to shape up and allow for jobs to happen, to change the housing patterns so that the black people can get the decent kind of home. Okay, just tap that particular need for trust into systems that have been corrupted and hardened, trusted, so they really find it very difficult to accommodate the kind of changes that are necessary to let people be fully human in our society. I'm talking to a group of ministers and prospective ministers. I'm talking to teams of people, pastors who work as field workers. And I have a word to say about loving the people with whom you work. You're not just dealing with issues, you're dealing with people. We're very much concerned with the plight of the blacks. Ron Karenga on the West Coast, sickened by the people who keep saying, yes, but what can we do? What can we do? Finally said, number one, get off our back. Quit criticizing us, telling us how you would have us do things, what sort of a way we should react to whatever you do, how our techniques should be geared, whether they should be less violent, less demonic, whether we should shape up a little first in the way we do things. Get off our back. Number two, make reparations. It's kind of a basic word for the church ever since Jim Sterling appeared on the scene. And that the action group working here in St. Louis. But reparations isn't a bad word, really. You know, if you bash into my tough car out here, you know, make reparations. I mean, that's okay, isn't it? Or if you took something from me, and like at the dining hall, you sat down and your two places set, and you ate mine before I got there, and I paid for it, you know. Maybe you didn't know I was coming, maybe you didn't even know the rest of the person was with me. If he's got to share the good things God intended, wasn't it physics for him? He's got far enough to retire, can't check on him. But somewhere, you know, it sounds like I've really been reading him, as he really haven't exactly. Somewhere, someone told me that someone said that there was a great sermon preached, and he asked you to preach the great sermon, and in it he was promoting the cause of Christian charity. And after it was over, then I guess they called him Fat Cat, started up to the great preacher and said that there was a very, very poor family in town, and I went down there and put food on their shelves and clothing on the children and that's all. Just kind of waiting for the pat on the back. And the great preacher was quiet for a while and finally said, God in his goodness has put an abundance of things here on this earth for his teachers. If you now have gathered more to yourself than you need, and you give it to another who didn't get what God intended, and it is to him, I pray you not. So let's teach it that people get what God intended for them, which we might have gotten a little bit more of than we really need. It's such a thing as being aware of where we have, just by virtue of our whiteness, moved in and gotten things rather easily that we'll never be able to get things. But the end is right, no separations, but now the third point. And I think he'd be very happy with what we're doing here today, because I think it comes under that category, although it's a kind of a food category, and I wouldn't like to think that that's what we're going to call this session. You go on back and civilize your white people. By that I don't mean to say that we should regard this as a force in civilization. Civilization is teaching. But there is a great deal that is uncivil and uncivilized about the way the whites have tolerated conditions that obtain for blacks. And there's a great need for us to pride ourselves in a civilization, the like of which no other eons of the world has seen, to see how very uncivilized our relations have been with people. And that means that we return to the suburbs, to the white community, with love. Now, I think we have seen a great many pastors claim to love their people very much. And all of us would admit to doing it imperfectly, but I think that's a great virtue. But I'm afraid I must also say that very often what is passed off as love is all too often pampering. I still find pastors who say our congregation isn't quite ready to hear talk about that power. Our congregation isn't quite ready to receive people of communion of another color. Or our congregation is ready to have one family, but it would not be ready for five families. And I must ask that pastor, how long have you been at that first pastor? And when they tell me 10, 15, 20 years, I have to ask, well, when in the heck are they ever going to get ready, man? But so is life a situation where some parents have a little child who, in learning to walk, falls those 6 inches to his little bottom and cries. And mother picks up that little child and loves it and says, you sweet little thing, we didn't mean to hurt you. We're not going to make you do that again. And so they don't worry about him learning to walk. And from now on, they carry him. And they put him in his walker and they push him. Now, at the age of 18, he comes to Bachelor of the University, and his mother is pushing him up to the registration line, and his big, gangly feet are hanging over the side of the buggy. He asks the mother if she's registering for school, and she says, no, I'm registering my child. I hope he finds a nice girl who will take over pushing the buggy for a while. But she hasn't loved this child at all if she hasn't learned how to walk yet. For all his being able to pass the college entrance exams and all his genius at being able to play checkers from his chair, he still is in great need of real love because he's been pampered if he hasn't learned how to walk. Now I have to say one more word of caution. If this guy is now 65 inches tall, and you're going to teach him to walk, you don't just dump him out of the buggy and say, walk, or standing up. He's going to need a lot of care. And no pampering. You've got to get the grip with the real problem he's got of learning how to walk. But you know, he's a lot farther from the ground than if you had started with him, and he was just a few inches from sitting down. So, in one breath, I say, yeah, look out for these people who have been pampered and permitted to go on with all kinds of racist ideas. We have been able to intellectualize a good relationship with the Negro, but we have never been able to take hands in congeniality and confidence with the black man. You're going to have to, if you deal with people who are racist, learn the great gift of identifying. If you're going to love and not pamper, you'd be well to take a good look at the book of Romans, the 12th chapter, which says, Let your love be without dissimulation. That's all the passage that should read. Don't let your love be seen. And the key for a love that is genuine is given a few verses later by St. Paul when he says, you've got to learn to laugh with those who laugh and weep with those who weep. And tell me, Pastor, how many times when you baptize a little child, do you really put yourself into the position where you know what this family has been through in those 9 months of waiting? A terrible thought of possibly deformity, of possibly stillbirth. The frightening thought of the delivery itself, even though thousands and thousands and thousands are born every day. To what extent do you put yourself into the shoes of these people who now have this healthy little child and been waiting breathlessly for the day when they could give him to their Lord and he would make his home in the little child and give him that event of participation in the crucifixion and resurrection? And what a great thrill it is for those things. Most of our congregations get annoyed and bored when there's a baptism because they haven't learned to rejoice with those who rejoice. And when prayers are spoken on behalf of people who are going to get married, people shrug it off with, I don't know that couple, or it's about time she landed someone, or any kind of thoughts except the kind that really stir in the thrill of two people in love who are going to begin their lives together. And in our churches, you know yourself, when you recite the list, you're saying to Mr. So-and-so who's got a broken leg, and you're saying to so-and-so who's got this, very often when it has pleased Almighty God to send him out of his veil of tears, you're more concerned about how he's going to, what he's going to say for that funeral, and how he's going to make it and get all these other things in. And it's so easy not to really weep with those who weep. What does it mean for a man to be laid up in the hospital with a broken leg and the wife to be both husband and wife, to be father and mother, and to make all kinds of trips to the hospital? And who's going to move in to even visit for her, to telephone her and encourage her, to take care of the kids for her, to see that there's a casserole for her, and a whole lot of other things that would really be putting yourself with them? Now, if you can begin to develop in yourself and in your people that kind of sensitivity, then you're also going to be sensitivity to the emotions that attend racism. With all the fears that are involved, with all the loneliness, all the pressures, and to be able to know the joy of turning the corner and getting over the fear and the prejudice. And that's implicated as a matter of fact. I have a feeling that one of the difficulties that we have in the whole matter of working through this devil, helping people over their prejudices and their lovelessnesses, is our obsession with the rational, stemming from such a great emphasis in our own personal lives for that which is academic. And I don't mean to mask this, but you know, when people do have a great love or a passionate dislike for someone, they always have reason. Why doesn't someone like a certain other clergyman or a certain member of their church? And they will say, well, he's pompous, he's cold, he's hard to get through to, he uses a very, very distant vocabulary, and you know, you get all these things. They all have a rationale. Now, when they counter those with this, well, he doesn't really. You look at the sermon, he used all monosyllabic words. Let's say first of all that my wife always tells me that I apologize too much. And so I sat out with the office today and say how indeed fortunate we are. I'm the greatest outliner that our Creator ever put together, will ever put together, right now. No matter what I say. I did try to get some vibrations last Saturday at one of my excursions to the year. I happened to live in my office in Chicago 4 nights a week in a cot, usually go about 5.5 days. But there was a seminar going on right across my office in New Cross College for Lutheran religion teachers. And I thought, well, maybe if I sat in and hearing what these talks have to say, it'd be something like your problem, teaching now, something. And one panelist, I don't even know how this fits in, but it was so funny. One panelist, and he wasn't trying to be funny, they were talking about curriculum, and he said, church history is a thing of the past. And it really does fit in, because the last 2 days here have in a sense said no to at least one definition of church history. And it said yes, I hope it has said yes, that church history or history must be related to the present or forget the future. I also asked, being a lot to do with black today, I asked a welfare mother who's been through a lot of trauma and tension and a whale of a lot of experience, both in a white community and in the ghetto and the project and so forth. I thought I'm going to be laughing with a bunch of pastors and would-be pastors and so forth, and what do you got to say about pastors? She said, well, they're all phony, except maybe two of them, and strangely enough, they're Lutheran. But all Lutheran pastors are phony too, but these two are not. So here I am, she told me. And I thought I'd think over who those two are. I don't cheer you up too much, but both of them are practically either been forced out or have been forced out of the ministry. Still gonna get those vibrations. As a layman, like black is beautiful, layman is beautiful, religion is beautiful. Christianity is beautiful, America is beautiful, and I'm the greatest. Okay. I have a concern I'd like to start out with and hope it gets me to the real concerns that I'd like to feel more. A year ago, because I had to find out what philosophy theology was saying, because I'm become very, very convinced. More and more, as I'm with particularly young people in traumatic conditions in the city, especially Lutheran young people, but more and more they're not necessarily Lutheran, and more I don't see too much difference. Become very, very convinced that coming at this thing in two different ways. I think right now you've got to deal with that. If I'm anywhere near correct, you're going to have to deal with it and really explore it hard. I just finished 4 months of young people in an intense situation in the city where all of our great goals were nowhere near accomplished. And I have the arrogance right now to say that I knew it wouldn't happen. But students from all over the country come into the city, half of them, quarter of them at least, Lutheran, and getting into the unfamiliar, getting thrown off balance, and up against the wall, and discovering that all of our resources from the past that they thought were so important are failing them. 3 weeks ago, we had 17 graduating seniors, Lutherans from Valparaiso University, that great place you just mentioned. Graduating seniors in the School of Education on 2 spots come to the city for 2.5 days. Now, the million people that we could have let them talk with, or sit with, or see, or touch, or smell, or feel, we can only pick so many. In 2.5 days, I might add, first of all, I sat with them for before they came in, and it was absolutely a waste of time. For the moment, it was. It was fun to think back later with them. But they had all the answers. And in 2.5 days, of just a few people, common people, city folk, a young lord, that's not. The brown young counselor, okay? A young lord, two school kids, black, teacher, so forth, and 2.5 days, they all of a sudden had absolutely no answers. None. And they were totally different people when they came back to reflect. The point I'm trying to make, when we reflected at the end of 4 months, 50 students and a faculty of 10, very radical faculty, and very different, competent faculty, which is not my bag, because we didn't have a football team. Maybe get one someday. We were reflecting on all the changes that had taken place in them for the last 4 months. And I had the arrogance to sit there for a whole day and predict every one of them. I didn't say a word that day, because I was trying to think of how I changed in the last 4 months. I'm talking about losing 1, 2, 3. And it took another day of reflection for me to discover that I'm in a different boat than they are. And for you theologians, scholastic theologians, I apologize for that, I'm not one, I'd like to be. It maybe may not make sense, but I know it's true. I'm in the New Testament, and they're in the Old Testament. Whether Lutherans or Jews or what. I'm talking about people who got enough smart, whoever gave it to them. Enough smart to know that if you draw any lines at all, you don't have an ultimate in that big debate of penultimate and ultimate. You don't have it. And so they're checking out things. The radical thoughts suddenly discover that they were about 80 years behind time in teaching, even though they're very radical in other areas of their life. And I discovered for myself more clearly that day that I have the promise. It's childlike, it's simple, it's memorized and drained by legalism, pietism, Lord knows what, memorization, in a world that never questioned anything. However I got it, I got it. And whether through wars, or the city, or the black, or the young, radicals in particular, and I think our heroes today, wherever it came from, I know this, that if my simple childlike promise that I have doesn't check out with all of reality, all of it, just a goodbye, it's not worth anything. And they're in a different boat, these sharp young people, and I'm not talking about escapees so much right now. They're not really sharp, open people, faculty and students, and Lutherans. They're in a world that didn't wait 46 years to question anything. They question it when they open their eyes out of the room and look at the world that's changing instead of rigid. And I'm not so sure that our ministry And our preparation for ministry should be so in such a one step, such a channeling system that we have in this country with socialization as education, because we've got it here, got it in all the parochial schools, got it in all the public schools. It's a one-track system. On the other hand, I'm very convinced that those churches out there, those congregations out there that you're going to serve, where people have it made, need to be served, but certainly much differently. And communities where they've got it made, where they're members of the church or not, or Christians or not. Certainly you deal with those people much differently than you deal with people who are looking for the promise. They're checking out Buddhism. They're checking out navel gazing and drugs and so forth. It's a whole different thing. And you know good and well that you also know that the whole world knows the message of Christianity that we've taught, we've preached, we've inspired, we've demonstrated everything at the place where we shake up or shut up. Whether you're a Lutheran teenager, a Viet Cong terrorist, or a Russian spy, that's the message. And that isn't the message of the gospel. And that sort of leads me to the point that I feel very strongly about. In one sense, I do apologize for coming at this point from absolutely no theological thing. On the other hand, the fact that I don't mean something. You know, check what I'm saying out very carefully. Luther's principle of law and gospel and two kingdoms, I'm absolutely convinced the most needed thing I know of today, in or out of the church. Because there is no church without a world, and there's no world without church. And I wish somebody someday do a dissertation or something on just why did God find it necessary to put tree in the garden. I mean, it's almost essential that he put a tree in the garden. And it's that long gospel I'd like to just comment a little bit about. And I'll reverse the thing, and I'll just throw out the gospel first, and then the law. I think it's supposed to get the other way. I gave you part of it when I said on the grave. But I'm also very convinced that if I were to ask an awful lot of, maybe here, I'm scared to ask, how many of you are racist? I think it made it very easy for you to hold up your hands. I think that most of you would. I certainly know that let's see about the most sophisticated the student is and has been around and seen things and help and so forth. But he quickly hold up his hand, he's a racist. Well, I say he's not very good listening. Because while everybody in this room is more than they realize, and that's deal with that a little bit, contributing, in spite of Billy Graham and Dick Nixon, contributing to mass murder, mass dehumanization that they like to talk about, including myself. Including the fact that I'm standing in a building built by racist contractors, racist trade unions, racist Lord knows what, racist money, racist institutions, I am not what I do. That's the message of the gospel. I am not what I do. It is to me at least. Now that's a groovy message if you're not comfortable. But when Pitchy Dick and Billy Graham speak, and I'm not talking about their heart, talking about what they say and their language, and what our pastors and parents and myself, and the language that we use, today, that isn't what we're saying. If I were to give a nice sermon here, and you don't have to prove yourself, you don't have to justify yourself. You're not what you do. It's what Jesus Christ, what God through Jesus Christ did for you, and what he feels for you, not what you do and feel about your brother. That isn't primary. Therefore, you don't have to dissent.
You don't have to demonstrate. You don't have to take a PTH. And the majority of the congregation will say, right on, Pastor, it's about time you stop to see those guys that demonstrate and defend and take a PTH. What kind of language is that? That's good. Billy Graham get this crowd of 50,000 and tell them, Jesus Christ, grace alone, fine, not acid, not sex, not obscenity. Nobody in there ever swore or screwed or anything else. And so they say, beautiful, Pastor, beautiful, I feel better. No. And when my Bible class teacher, whom I highly respect, I really do. You don't compare a Lutheran pastor only in the fall, a Lutheran pastor with first thing fall, because you're in the White House. Billy Graham can talk all he wants about separation of church and state, but he's in the White House. Anyhow, a year ago I called up. I was really concerned about these things. And I called up a theologian here, the seminary, who's one of the five I highly respect and synod. I don't know any more than five. And I said, don't give me a long thing. I just want one thing. It's very important to me right now. One thing. And what? When you say long gospel, you sound like a big law gospel man and so forth, the principle of long gospel. What do you mean? One thing. Cover that. And he had a cold and he was eating lunch and said, give me a second. And he said, the law is the factual reality of man's existence and God's will apart from the encounter with Jesus Christ, the corporate himself. And I said, right on and hang up. Because if the principle of law gospel means anything, and I happen to think it does, I think there's nothing more boring. And I don't care how sharp a guy is, the average young person today, that's intellectually sharp and aware of the media or whatnot, or whatever God gifts with them, then the gospel without the law, it's absolutely boring. And so how beautiful is it boring? And it's also very boring if that law, if you make the distinction, proper distinction, I don't find and hear the proper distinction being made very often by myself, my wife, my friends, pastors, and everything, either out of ignorance or what. But usually the distinction is never made, and it's called yuck. You don't know what it is, you know. God loves us here, forgive us. What is it? Law is a gospel. But usually, when the law and gospel are preached, it's the Billy Graham Nixon variety. It's the one that has separated Sunday from Monday. It's the one that separated body from soul, private from public. Full of paradoxes. Lutheran Church is full of them. The Catholic Church is full of them. Man and Stalin and Lenin are full of them. And Americanism and the rugged individualism are full of them. We go, we're the priesthood of all believers. Ho, ho, ho. Amen. We go to communion, the fellowship. All it is private confession, absolution, and they're getting rid of it. The way we go. Catholics, just the opposite. Since Vatican II, they're rushing headlong to see how fast they can have a little Methodist table and get rid of the altar. And we go right by each other. And so forth. I don't know if I'm coming through. But until we understand that all creativity, and God's concerned about that, I think, is in that tension between the public and the private. I don't think we're kidding ourselves and teach the gospel all you want. Until we understand that all you guys in this room have something directly to do with poor people and black people dying in Vietnam, and you're taking their place, or they're taking yours. Do you understand that? Do you understand when you put that silver chalice to your lips and sing glorious hallelujahs and thanks be to God that we're the one body as we eat of the one body? If you can't celebrate the fact that the silver in that chalice probably came from the dead bodies of black people in South Africa, and a lot of dead bodies to get it here, you know, I don't think you understand of what it means to go to class. I mean, not many of you folks around too much, and you might go too fast now and then on the highway that you can control that. See, I can't deal with myself. I'm trying to pass this to a war that I consider the ultimate in imperialism. We got some close arguments for imperialism in this country, domestic imperialism. You know and I know that most Lutherans connect capitalism with Christianity. How horrible. And capitalism means profit. And today it means a lot, something a lot different than it meant when my granddaddy was operating and trying to make a buck. Or my daddy, when you had to be efficient, you had to work hard, you had to slave to get a roof over your head, to get food in a world that was tough and rigid. And you know, I know that we made gods out of that. Doc Rager University, I know welfare. Low salary, but my salary would be a lot lower if HUD, Housing and Urban Development, didn't build $1 million dormitories and recently finished 6 $300,000 fraternity houses with 38 years to pay, no down payment, and 3% interest. HUD. No poor person can get that kind of loan, and those fraternity boys never worked a day in their life. I know in the world, and I'm talking about you, I'm talking about myself. You have to make your own decisions. But unless you can check out the promise that you've got memorized so well against all reality, forget it. None of them I've checked out is paying income tax. For me, there's no question about it. I am contributing to that nice clean bonding of people. Napalming people and brutalizing people here and abroad by my income tax, 70 cents on a dollar. And nobody can kid me, I don't need to rationalize because I've already rationalized, and my rationalization has come out this way. For my children's sake, for my wife's sake, for my sake, for justice's sake, for my time's sake, my decision is it will be better if I withheld my income tax and let them do what they want with me. It would say more, speak louder, not someday, now. No promise, and keep chicken. And I think the gospel is for chicken people, not for people that have it made. So, the law, corporate law. I went to a been in China before Mao came in. I think Mao was being used by God. And the Chinese family, as that came to man, beautiful. Been rich off for 2,000 years. Respect for mother, father, grandmother, great, 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 great grandmother and father. But the Chinese family couldn't give a rip for the family next door. I'm saying this only because I see a parallel in this country. 70% my estimation, no higher score, one guess. 70% of college young people went home for Christmas had a nightmare instead of a time or both. God used non-communism to destroy basic institutions in this world. Rather, a prostitution of a basic institution in this world, and he's done the exact same thing to the institution called family that we have prostituted in this country. Don't give me all that Monahan report, Charles. When he talks about the black family, we learned that 8 years ago in the city when young people came into the city, white middle class young people came into the city to do their tutoring when they could. Sure, you're not allowed to. It didn't make any difference. You didn't have to go anyhow before the curfew. Because it didn't make any difference. But when they came in, they had a problem. Same problem we have today, only the things different, things have changed. Don't let anybody kid you. They had a problem, I know, I was with them, we live with them. We live in the black west side of Chicago. We live with black families doing the riot. Live in Cabrini, second largest Negro project. Had five apartments. And those projects were, there was gun shooting and fire, sniper fire, everything in that last week. That time, young people loosened, all the resources were pulled out from them. What they said? They said, church is bad, home is bad, white middle class is terrible, loosened teenager, you're terrible, telling himself. And they became black and poor. That's discrimination. The moment you think you've got nothing to offer, discrimination. Today the thing is just a little different. I lost a son there. Let me go to my family again for a moment. Those early years, the people that came into our volunteer program, to a great extent, were up against the wall at the universities, home, church, and so forth, and they left as individuals. That's kind of what I'm telling you here are facts, and I'm a certain of facts. If you don't buy them, fine, but I'm not trying to pick a philosophy or something on you. And they left their homes and came in and through our organization, which was sponsored by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. You know, there's some questions to that, but they found that subtly or somewhere or another that the institution was still alive for them as they had to get away. And that seems changed. And I'm very convinced now that institutions like Valparaiso University and this seminary, University of Illinois, the federal government, any institution you want in this country is in hot water. And I find the sharp open people coming in as individuals to learn and to discover the realities, particularly the corporate realities of socialization, that have been denied them all their lives in order to go back and keep hope alive for the institution. And the basic institution, I'm convinced, is the family. And hopefully somebody really picks up on that and stays with it hard. Because I've learned something the hard way in the last few years, that those people that talk about institutional choice as some sort of meaning are also making that wall between the public and the private. Because institutional state is synonymous with state. And if you really understand that statement, you don't have to worry too much about what am I going to do about all these things.